We're talking about the 1981-82.
Right, election.
Election.
And yeah, so I got onto this, the life insurance program. It was an experience-based program. What that meant was the university would just pass the money through. The university would collect the money from the faculty who enrolled, and pass that on to the insurance company, which built up a fund to pay off claims based on the experience. Okay? Well, faculty are, you know, crusty old birds that last forever. This fund was getting enormous because there were no claims. But it was faculty money paid. It was not university contribution. So after the election in 78, the Faculty Affairs Committee raised the benefits without changing the premium. It was announced by Keith Grody in his office as an improvement in benefits sponsored by the university. It's a flat lie.
Mm-hmm.
So we got all of this, all the information on this Hummer, put together a package, met with the trustees, and Howe and Bruff were on the trustees, were trustees at that time, and we had a public meeting and we laid out what had happened and how the faculty had been conned on this. And Keith said, well, it had been a misnomer.
Misnomer.
And that was a very good meeting with the trustees. And they said, well, we understand what you're saying. We recognize what happened. Where do we go from here? And we said, well, you got to put it out on bids. Well, they didn't like that. Keith didn't like that. Because they have their, you know, I understand, they have their relationships with existing companies. They're familiar with them, comfortable with them. You know, why change? And they really wouldn't have had to change except that they'd mucked it up so badly. And they knew it when they did it. Because Gary, what's his name from business school,
Stolick.
Told him. He said, if you do this, you're going to bankrupt that fund. So, at any rate. So we had this enormous meeting. Well, it wasn't just faculty that were in this. Now, this was a big meeting. We were over in Miles. What's that office building where Grody is?
Manly Miles,
yeah. Mm-hmm. We were over there. And the unions were there, because they were affected by all this too. CT union, you know, all of the operating engineers, everybody was there. And they brought in this consultant, and he started blowing smoke about all, you know, the complexities of all of this. And I said, and I interrupted him, I said, how do you write up a bid? So he went on and he explained how he's writing it. I said, so you mean it's easy? And he said, yes. And that's when we got a bid on the life insurance policy. So we had the two dimensions to it. Well, you know, that took an enormous amount of time, learning things I didn't care to learn. And Bob Repus was great in this. MEA was helpful in this, trying to explain some of this to us. And so that became what we thought was a big issue. They clearly had manipulated this and had not acted in the best interests of the faculty. And then at the same time, we have this dissolution or threatened dissolution of colleges, and I thought, boy, this is going to be You know, if we can't make it now, with Cecil Mackey there, is it was kind of a cold fish. I mean, that was that characterization came from to me from one of the trustees. That's the way he was seen, and the AAUP decided also at this point that that the time was ripe. So they really became active in organizing a campaign, and in fact took the lead. And we decided, you know, if they can get their 30%, fine, let them get 30%, and we'll just, with our 10%, we'll get on the ballot as well. Well, they collected their cards, and they announced how many cards they'd collected, 800, 900, something like that. And lo and behold, Keith Grody came up with a list that was big enough so they didn't have 30%. Mm-hmm. And I saw Roy Matthews, who was very strong AAUP, right after that. Okay. And when we had been in that position, his comment to me was, "Can't you guys count?" So I was able to throw that one back at him, and he couldn't figure out how that happened. I said, "Well, you told him how many people to put on the list." and that was kind of I thought that was a good campaign. Billy Evans did a great job, I thought. What hurt not the union effort. The union effort was about the same. Resulted in about the same. What hurt MEA, we wound up with the smaller portion this time. What hurt us was the AAUP assertion that if you wanted a union on campus, you had to vote for AAUP. Because the faculty associates people, in the end, felt stronger about a union than about the association. And in the runoff election, they would vote for AAUP rather than no. On the other hand, the AAUP people felt stronger about AAUP than they did about union. And if faculty associates was in the runoff, AAU people would not vote for them, and the union effort would fail. Wasn't inaccurate. I thought it was dirty, you know, but at any rate, it was moot. And if you look back over all three of those elections, I don't remember the numbers from the 72 election, but I'm confident they are the same, that there were about in the neighborhood of 800 to 900 people who voted for union in each of these elections, which was in fact about 30% of the faculty. It was better than 30% of those who voted in each case, you know, but never enough to get to the 50% that would be needed to run off against no. Now that was that last one that ended. The circumstances were such that if it was going to happen, it was going to happen then, and that really ended, you know, the movement for a union on campus. But the consequences, I think, of that of the union movement are still around on campus. I think the procedures are more open. The grievance procedure is markedly improved. The salary lists are published now. You know what's going on, the criteria for promotion and tenure are more clearly articulated. You know, I think the tenure system has been strengthened. Faculty control over curriculum. I mean, all of that, I think, I would say is all those elements have been improved or strengthened because there was a union movement. So, you know, Zoltan used to say, this is called, I suppose, what every election winner would say. He'd look at the programs that were enacted afterwards and say, well, those were our programs. Who won the election? You know, they may be sitting in the office, but who won the election? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go that far, but it was a worthwhile effort. You know, I don't regret any of the energies that I put into it, and they were considerable. And you know, ultimately, it didn't damage me. You know, I do know that when I became associate dean, I ran into Bob Banks. See, Bob was then, he took over the second campaign. He really was the academic one who ran the anti-union campaign. But he was not as aggressive or as, you know. And he said, I count him as a friend today. But I must say, when I showed up as associate dean different places, here were all these people, you know, who had been sitting on the other side of the table in various circumstances, wondering what the hell this meant, you know. Yeah. Whether
who sold out.
Yeah. And whether they had to watch their P's and Q's or something happened, you know. That was, you know.
It's interesting. Could you talk a little bit about your scholarship in the 1980s or 70s? You were working on your oral histories?
Yeah, first major project. Of course, it was my dissertation, and I got an article out of that. But then, what was really interesting about that was, I think, the left wing sort of movement it purported to be. But the Autolite strike, I had not really been done in a scholarly way. There had been some books written on it, and the timing was right, and the money was there, so I could devote the whole summer and take two students down to Toledo and conduct interviews. I wrote up the process for the Labor History Journal about what we did there and got some nice notes about that. When the book was published, I got some nice, very nice reviews of that, and several notes about the oral history, my description of doing oral history, that were very complimentary. These were quite welcome, because this is the same times that I was getting, you know, poison pen notes from people who were opposed to the union.
Mm-hmm.
But I should back up to say that in public, it was very civil you'd be amazed in private the scurrilous sort of shit that would come my way. Unsigned.
Yeah.
You know, nasty, nasty notes. But anyway, so that, you know, and that was sustaining, you know, to be able to engage in that sort of scholarship that really interested me. It was the Autolite book was a very difficult book, because it was a new area doing oral history. What do you keep? What do you cut? You know, we didn't have money for transcribing, so I had to work out. I didn't have much money for it, so I had some friends do some of it here and there, and then transcribe some of it myself and typed it up. Man, it was well before computers and any of this stuff, you know, because.
A lot of work.
Yeah. And so you wind up with, you know, 1,000 pages of manuscript and then have to cut it down. And I was getting kind of frustrated with it, and I sent it off to Meg, and she had some, she had gone on to the American Studies program in Minnesota. the student who had worked with me. I sent it over there and said, you take a hand at cutting some of this stuff. And so she did. And that helped. And I got back on track and got it down to a reasonable manuscript of 300-400 pages. And I sent it around, I think, to a couple places without much success, and then sent it over to Dick Chapin at MSU. And he called me up and wanted to have lunch, which I took as a good sign. So we went over to the university club, and he bought me lunch. And he said that he didn't really approve of oral histories. I thought, oh, shit, he's bringing me over here to tell me that he doesn't approve of this. There's something else going on. And well, he said, but, you know, I read your manuscript and you made a believer out of me. And so that's how that one worked out. And he did a very nice job in putting it together. And that one ran fairly well. It was picked up in a couple of courses, so it went to a second printing, which meant, you know, a full $400 or $500 right. for the whole thing in my pocket, you know. But they got their expenses and it got published, and that was really the most important part for me.
What do you remember about the interview processes that you went through and the workers that you interviewed?
Well, it was a very you had to be very careful. The students were well. Let me back up. First thing that was very clear is that I was a professor and these were working class people that I was interviewing. Whether they were police, whether they were strikers, whether they were scabs. So there's a class and social difference there. And so, you know, I had to think through how I was going to approach them so that they would be comfortable and trusting, how to establish rapport. And I had a different problem from the problem the students had. Because the students had a certain advantage because they weren't supposed to know. And I trained them in this too. I said, you don't know. And you're just going to continually ask for clarification. You know, you're not telling them anything. They're telling you, and they're explaining it to you. And you're, you know, this naive listener, and you want to know. And so, and they did it very well. You know, both Meg and Claude was a little more relaxed at this, I think. Meg was kind of an intense person, and she did know things. And I kept telling her, you don't know. But I had the problem of being somebody who, they said, well, of course you know. And I'd have to say, no, I don't know. So it was always a challenge to sit down with people. I tried and establish this sort of connection where they would kind of freely tell you what they recalled. And I always tried to do it in a setting that was comfortable to them, their homes, or any place they chose. And I had to play the naive listener too. I had to be even more careful about not offering things. And the way what I chose to do was to use keywords, but I modeled this really after what a non-directional psychologist does. And I would listen until they used a term that warranted some elaboration or that seemed to be charged. And I just repeat the term back to them in a questioning way. You know, if they said scab, I'd just say scab. And then they'd go and tell you what that meant, you know. And that worked very well. That worked well there. It worked. I did two other books. One on the carpenters, union carpenters in Michigan, and one on the Minneapolis Teamster strike. The Michigan, well, the Teamster strike was part of the second phase of this same research project that was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And so summer of 73, I went to Toledo. Summer of 74, I went to Minneapolis. Again, with two students, undergraduate students with me to conduct interviews and to help with all the paperwork and that sort of thing. Took me a while to get those things published, you know, because it was a hand operation, getting the manuscripts together, and, well, getting it transcribed and all that. So I was trying to fit that in while I was trying to organize faculty and teach courses
in your spare time,
and do other things, you know. So, and then the Carpenter's book, I was approached. I was very supportive of the Michigan Council for the Humanities. I'd known Ron for a while,
That's Ron Means?
Means, yeah. And I'd made some presentations for them using some of this oral history materials for their annual conferences, you know, as a way to try and encourage people to do oral histories. And I'd made some other presentations there, you know. While I'm thinking about that, was on a panel for the National Oral History Association was here, and we talked about oral history. And I went down to Wayne State when the State Oral History Association began at the Ruther Library. I think Geneva was there. And
mm-hmm. Justin, probably?
Yeah, yeah, yes, I think Justin Kestenbaum was down there, too. And the guy from Wall Lake.
Glenn Ruggles.
Yep, Glenn Ruggles was there. And it's people from the Ruther Library, mm-hmm. you know, that had done some interviewing themselves. But so the Carpenters, for the centennial, were looking for somebody to do something. And they had a little bit of money. So I agreed to do an oral history there of the where I would interview retired carpenters. And the focus in that was there were two foci. One was the union, and how that had impacted the way they did their job and the way they lived, etc. And the other was the impact of changing technologies on the work. And that was a fun project. You know, I went all over the state. I was up Escanaba and Iron River and Alpena and, of course, Detroit area And of course, in Sault Ste. Marie, the Carpenters Union is a very complex union. It's not just people who nail boards together. It includes pile drivers and machinists, you know, that install their millwrights, you know, who install heavy machinery mm-hmm. and flooring and all of that. So that was, I learned some things there and had some fun doing it and produced a good book. Carpenters are happy with it, you know, and the state. I think we sold out on that one. You know, union people bought it, and it had a wider audience than the union people in Michigan, because mm-hmm. I had some correspondence and some comments at conferences I went to about it. People who'd read it thought it was okay.
How was it that you got involved in administration within the college?
Well. It really is the department, you know. I had been, you know, active, serving on everything in the department, you know, from, as I said, I was elected to the advisory council the first year I was here. So I was on and off, you know, one thing after another all the way through. And then, of course, there was the, when Henry, Silverman, in what I recognize as very difficult circumstances, difficult being Al Hollingsworth as the dean, tried to make some changes in the department that many of us thought were inappropriate, mainly an attack on the American Studies curriculum at the core of a writing program. And that led, of course, to a revolution in the at the time of his of the when he came up for review. And I was one of the three, four candidates in the runoff. Henry Jocelyn, Jenny Banks, and I were all candidates. I think there may have been another one, too. I don't remember who. But at any rate, it came down to a ballot with three of us. Henry and Jocelyn and I were on the ballot for the chair. And Jocelyn and Henry were one vote apart. I think Jocelyn had one more than Henry. And I think it was, and I had probably half what each of them had. And when I went over to talk to John, he interviewed all three of us. And I said,
this is John Eady?
Yeah, John Eady, the dean of the college. And I said, if you appointed me, I'd have a lot of trouble because I'm, would be a minority candidate. But it's very clear from the split of the vote between Jocelyn and me that Henry no longer enjoys the mandate heaven. And if you're going to interpret the vote for me, a lot of that is personal loyalties, but they would, I'm sure, transfer to Jocelyn if I were not there. So she was appointed chair. I never did tell her that, now that I think about it. She was appointed chair. Henry had a snit. And so then she had to put together her administration. And Milt had been in there. That's right.
Milt as one of the other candidates?
Yeah, he had been one of the candidates, too. Fine guy. Think the world of Milt. And so she chose Milt as the associate chair. And that was fine. I was very comfortable with that. And then she was having some trouble getting somebody to do the developmental. And she called me and I said, this is not my cup of tea. She said, okay. Then she called back and she said, well, if I help you brew it, well, it'd be your cup of tea. So I agreed to do that, with some conditions, because that was, it wasn't really that complicated, because what I saw immediately was that we were going to get graduate students, and that had to be handled very well and very carefully, or we were going to have a lot of trouble. And I wanted to make sure that that we didn't just hire them and say, go do it, that we wanted to have a system. And I'd had a conversation in my interview with the dean about that, too, about the use of graduate students. And so I shared that view with her, and she said, that's right. Will you do it? So I said I would. So so then I brought together the people who had been teaching in developmental or who were process-oriented and the process approach to writing. And Sherry Thomas and Maria and Blaine and Mike Steinberg and I don't remember who all. And I said, we got to do this right. And you guys have been more involved in this than I have, so I want you to take the lead on putting together the pedagogy and the curriculum in this. And I'll support you, and you know, I'm going to monitor. You know, I want to know what you're doing, and I'm still the one that's going to be responsible. So we're going to have to agree. So they went along, and then I went with. Did Jocelyn go or did I go? I made the proposal. I don't remember the mechanics of this. I made the proposal that what we really needed was to have graduate students from the entire college, not just one department, that we needed a training program, and that we needed a retreat when we get to get this all together. My God, he funded it. And so we went up to Kettman Center, and John Smolens, I remember he was there too, and we had a terrific time and really laid it out. And these were graduate students from history, music, English, of course, philosophy. You know, they were from around the college. So it was art. I think we had one from art. Yes, we did. So I think almost every department was represented. And then we had weekly seminars.